You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
It's the 8th of February 2017. I'm Simon Copland.
And I'm Benjamin Riley.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about respectability politics.
But before we jump into the topic, we just wanted to let people know that we have finally done something that we probably should have done ages ago, or when we first started the podcast, which is set up an email address that people can get in touch with us at. We were just having a chat before we started recording that. We obviously give our contact details as in terms of our Twitter accounts at the end of every episode, but obviously not everyone has Twitter, and I can see how potentially people might feel a bit uncomfortable getting in touch with us in a public forum like that. So you can now get in touch with us via our new brand new email address, which is queerspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we'd really like it if you got in touch and gave us ideas or told us what you think, or, you know, if you have any feedback about anything that we're doing, we'd really love to hear from you.
Yeah, so we're not 100% sure what we're going to do with the email address in the long term. I mean, we've talked on here before about wanting to incorporate more sort of a conversation with our listeners into the podcast. So that will hopefully eventually become a way of doing that. But at the moment, yeah, it would be great to just hear people's thoughts and questions and comments and all of that stuff.
Yep. That sounds great. Shall we get on with this episode though?
Yeah, so we were talking about respectability politics today, and we kind of got thinking about this topic after I recently watched the music video for a pop song called House of Air by Australian musician Brendan McLean. The video is very sexually explicit, and while I would say it's had a really positive critical response, it's also had some pretty strong negative reactions. And those reactions have arguably been rooted in respectability politics.
So respectability politics usually refers to a practice in identity-based political movements of achieving political gains by proving to our political and social majority that members of the marginalised group are deserving of those gains because we are just like you. This is particularly visible in advocacy around marriage, and in fact, some would argue the issue of marriage equality itself is a perfect example of respectability politics.
What tends to happen in respectability politics is that the most, quote, socially acceptable people from a given group are put forward as kind of exemplars, a symbol to help win political gains, while others, including often the most marginalized members of a group, are hidden from sight. This is perhaps due to an implicit fear that society will reject the group as a whole if they are frightened off by the group's less respectable members.
We also just wanted to put a warning here that we are probably going to be talking about some more sexually explicit subject matter than we usually would on Queers. So just bear that in mind as we go forward.
So let's jump right into it. Simon, you hadn't heard about this video until I sent it to you. I think your first response was, "Is it safe enough for me to watch in the library?" And I was like, "Oh, maybe. Maybe not.
Definitely not.
Definitely not." It's got some pretty extreme reactions, and something that people sort of predicted as soon as the video was released and very quickly happened was like those reaction videos on YouTube, which are quite funny. So maybe the best way to get into it is for you to have a go at describing what this video clip actually is.
Yeah, so I think maybe in some ways the best way to describe it is to take some stuff from Brendan himself, who actually wrote about this in The Guardian just yesterday, so this is kind of valuable. So he calls it a light-hearted, extremely explicit look at the world of gay semiotics. So the video is kind of a... it looks like it's filmed in probably an 80s porn shoot, or 80s or 90s porn shoot, I would suggest. Maybe even going back to the 70s, really old school sort of gay characters. And it goes through the semiotics of the Hanky Code. And so the Hanky Code, for people who don't know, was a code that gay men used where you would have particular... hankies tucked into your pants or to your shirts that would identify particular sexual practices that you are searching for. So one color hanky. I'm gonna get my hanky colors wrong.
It's very elaborate.
Yeah. So I think a blue hanky meant that you were looking for anal sex. And on the side, the pocket that you had it on, left or right, determined whether you were looking for to be the more active or passive. I don't like those terms. More top or bottom in that situation. Brown meant that you were looking for scat. There's different colors for oral sex or for fisting or for etc etc etc. And so the video is sort of looking at this, and what it basically is doing is showing people who have these particular hankies. It's got little lines with text about it, about the code and what it all means. And then as it goes on, it sort of starts off quite lighthearted, and then as it goes on, it gets more and more sexually explicit, where you have got Brendan said in this article that they hired porn stars. There is one fisting scene, for example, which is not just a sort of, let's just make the camera look funny so it looks like there's fisting. There's actual fisting going on. There's actual oral sex going on. There's actual anal sex going on. And I think at the end there's actual scat going on as well.
It's kind of worth describing specifically the final shot of the video, which is this kind of, like, I was kind of watching it sitting at my desk at work, funnily enough, because, I work for a queer organization, so there are people watching worse things at their computers. And the final shot of the video is Brendan, the musician, lying on the ground and looking at the camera, and you just see like an ass descend over his face, and like the final thing in the video is basically someone shitting on his face, and it's kind of ramped up to this over the course of the video as each kind of sex act depicted gets more and more extreme. It's also worth saying that Gay Semiotics was an essay
yes
by Hal Fisher from 1977, so that's kind of what the
which Brendan said was the inspiration for the video.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
And yeah. I think it's just I really like the start of Brendan's article, because he talks about that particular scene of being shat on. He doesn't talk about it exclusively, but the article, which we'll put in the show notes, he starts off with as the shimmering lube smeared bottom descended over my face while the cameras rolled, one question ran through my mind: not have I taken this music video too far, but instead have I taken this far enough. I don't know. I'm not sure how much further he probably could have taken it in that context, but I think sure. It would have been an interesting attempt to go even further.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's kind of worth now talking about what some of the negative responses to it have been. So the positive responses, I would say, I really like the video, and I think my thoughts about it have probably been pretty widely reflected in responses to it, which is, I like how boundary pushing it is, and I like that it has that kind of odd tone of both lighthearted and silly whilst also being really sexually explicit. And we'll probably get into a bit more about the sort of the political implications of that later on in the discussion. But have you seen some of the more negative reactions to
No,
it,
I really haven't, to be honest. Since you brought it to me, I just haven't had the time to I've been too busy doing other stuff to be able to dive in and have a look. So I'm going to
look. I can probably guess it. Yeah. I mean, and trolling the internet for negative responses to queer content is, I don't think, anyone's idea of a good time, so that's understandable.
Oh, it can be fun sometimes to look at what people
sure. Hate reading.
Yeah. I mean,
so they...
You go. Sorry, I think it would be good... You go, because you've probably seen more of it than I have.
Yes, yeah. They broadly fall into two categories. There are the predictable ones from sort of pearl clutching, won't somebody think of the children type people. Like, it's on the video is on YouTube, which is astonishing to me. Not that he put it on YouTube, because why wouldn't you do that, but the fact that it's still there, at least as of recording, is great. It's got hundreds of thousands of views, and YouTube is notoriously the kind of asshole of the internet, and
in this case comment. Literally.
Well, yes, indeed. Or I should say the comment threads on YouTube are just notoriously horrible. But there's just lots of, predictably gross homophobic stuff. So there's all that kind of stuff. But the more interesting reactions, I think, I mean, that's interesting as well, I think, in its own way, but the more interesting reactions to me are the ones from gay men, and there have been quite a lot of them, that basically go along the lines of, this video doesn't represent me, I don't see how this can be called a really gay video, like it's this really specific thing, or it's this really, they might say it's a really kind of gross thing, and like, how, essentially the vibe is, how dare you associate me with this by implication, I guess. And so there's a lot of that sort of thing, which to me is just like textbook respectability
politics. I think it's interesting in a couple of ways. The first is the assumption that because it's a gay thing or a gay thing, you know, like what, you know, it's, you know, she talks about it being gay semiotic, so there's a sort of gay label to it. There's the assumption automatically that it has to represent all, that it automatically represents all of the gay community, whatever that is. You know, we've had those conversations in the past. But I think that is interesting, and it goes to a lot of respectability politics that say, if you're sexually explicit, we're going to attack you for not representing the entire community. And when that occurs in the opposite, when someone will say, well, this represents part of my community, that sort of, it's ignored, or it's often, or when, you know, when we talk about marriage equality, for example, which is one of the examples we've brought up, when I say things like, that doesn't represent the part of the queer community that I'm part of, or the part that I really want to be part of, people will come back automatically and say, well, you know, that's okay, but we've got to have, you know, it's important for lots of people, gay people, so what, you know, stop making your complaints. A lot of respectability politics is often, I find that often works in that kind of way,
That's kind of an interesting comparison too, because on the surface of it, you could kind of say, what's the difference between you looking at a marriage equality video and saying that doesn't represent me, and someone doing the same thing looking at something like the House of Air video. And I would say that the difference there is that one of them is sort of explicitly claiming to represent all gay people, and one of them is not. The whole kind of marketing for the marriage equality movement has really, I would say, very much been rooted in the idea of presenting not just a vision of queers that want to get married, but a vision of queers as a whole, of being exactly who queers are, and that who they are is someone that is safe. And socially acceptable.
Well, and that's actually been essential to marriage equality, to the acceptance of marriage equality, to allow access to that institution. We have had to present ourselves as safe and as acceptable to the rest of the community, to the rest of the broader community, and that means that marriage equality has had to create a picture of everybody being like that, and has had to actively sort of push out the people or reject the people who don't act in that particular kind of way, which is respectability politics epitomized. I think that you're right in that the difference between that and what Brendan is doing is that Brendan has said this is about a particular subculture, a gay subculture, around semiotics.
One that absolutely exists.
But that absolutely exists, 100%. But it's, you know, it's not, I don't think he's trying to represent everybody who identifies as some sort of queer. And I think that that's important, and I think it's valuable and really important to talk about this particular subculture. And I think it's a thing that, you know, it's interesting, and it's a part of people's lives, and it's a real thing that's out there that exists, and I like that he's tackled it in this kind of way.
Beyond that sort of anthropological bent, you know, kind of saying that this is a thing that's real and exists, and it's important to represent the diversity of the queer community, I feel like there's something almost more interesting here, that it's not just about representing a part of the community that doesn't usually get seen, but or a part of a lot of people's lives that doesn't usually get seen, although I think that that's true. There is, I think, some value in explicitly setting out to shock people and to be I don't know if Brendan himself would use this word, but almost antagonistic, you know, in really kind of putting this in people's faces and saying this is something that happens, and you know, there is some value perhaps in you being confronted by this.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think he talks about, for example, the pushing of the boundaries around art, around how queer art can push boundaries, and how this sort of sexually explicit approach has the capacity to do that. I'm intrigued about the political value of it. I think it's valuable as art, and I'm not gonna. And I think it's great, and I love the video, and I think it's excellent. And it's valuable as art. I think it's worth diving into whether this sort of shock value stuff has political value as well. I think my tendency is to say yes, based on, you know, that pushing those boundaries in this kind of way allows us to push boundaries in other kinds of ways as well. So in this instance, it really is talking explicitly about sex, sort of pushes the, you know, forces you to open your eyes about the particular types of sex that gay people have. And one of the things about respectability politics, in particular the marriage equality campaign, has been the complete erasure, I think, of sex from the queer narrative. So it's not about sex, it's not about who we fuck anymore. It's about who we love, in that sense. And the erasure of sex is ongoing, and it's a thing that really frustrates me, because for me, being queer is about who I want to, who you're sexually attracted to. You know, I can love whoever I want, but you know, the integral part of queerness in many ways is sex and fucking. And we don't talk about that. We don't talk about the different types of sex. We don't talk about the way that we can have sex, how, and most importantly, we don't talk about how great sex can be and how much fun it can be.
Totally, totally. And it's funny to reflect on the fact that we often also don't talk about it on this podcast. Not that I feel like we actively avoid it, but yeah, I think it's interesting that we don't.
Even that we had to give a little warning about being sexually explicit.
Which in and of itself is telling, I guess. This is maybe a bit of a tangent, but I'm so fascinated by the fact that you said it's not even about who we love, it's about who we're sexually attracted to. And you know, we did an episode early on in the podcast about that idea, that primacy of kind of love and romance to queer political movements. And that to me is still a really interesting topic. And I think to look again, I mean, you know, I don't want to keep coming back again and again to the marriage equality movement, but it is so useful that it's been so framed around love and the idea that the basis of us deserving a given, say, like political right, is who we love, and to me that's bizarre. Like it's a kind of weird elision of sex completely.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that, I mean, it makes sense in many ways, in that love is, it's, you know, it's got that, obviously that sort of romantic ideal, or that ideal, you know, it's something that, you know, that people say it crosses boundaries, and love conquers all, and all that sort of we've got this really, it's ingrained in our social consciousness of being such an important. An important value and an emotion to be able to feel, and so I can understand how a marriage equality movement sort of tapped into love as a way of dealing with this, but in turn it has become a very a sort of respectable way of dealing with this issue. So we can ignore the icky stuff around sex that a lot of conservatives in particular don't want to talk about and don't want to deal with, and we can. Picture ourselves, we can frame ourselves as these people who just sort of who love each other like everybody else loves each other. So we, you know, and that means that we love each other monogamously, and we love each other with vanilla sex even though we don't talk about it, and we love each other in that sort of you know, in the video that happened, that GetUp released years ago, the It's Time video, I think it was, you know, the one that has the very linear version of a relationship, and that's what it's all about. It's not about, you know, and again, in that version there was no fucking, there was no sex, there was nothing
Well,
that.
there wasn't even any homosexuality. The fact that they were gay was the twist ending,
Yeah, absolutely.
which is why that video is so kind of awful.
It's one of the reasons why that video was so awful.
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah. No, I was going to say something just on your point about that thing being love being a way of saying we are just like everyone else. I think what's great also about Brandon's video is the reminder that, I mean, maybe that's true. What I mean, love is such a kind of shitty, like, nothing concept, I think, in a lot of ways. It's important to be reminded that a lot of us don't fuck like everyone else does. Mm. And that's that kind of, it's such a stark reminder of difference, of the fact that we are other. And, you know, as we've talked about before, the fact that we have to come out, for example, is evidence of that. And trying to pretend that that's not true, when it just is dangerous, I think.
Yeah, and I think that this goes down the track of what I really hate about respectability politics, and that I think that respectability politics is a very negative approach to dealing with rights campaigns for rights, and that what it does is it attempts to get rid of our differences and say that differences that we have as a community, you know, and historically that we've had, we don't want them anymore. They're actually really negative to us, and that we must get rid of them. And I think that has a really negative approach on us as a community and the way that we have sex. So, you know, if you understand, you know, a lot of the ways that, you know, if we talk specifically about how we have sex differently, for example, how queer people might have sex differently than other people, part of that is, you know, just because of the biological realities of, you know, queer sex being different to straight sex at times. Part of that is also, however, due to a histories of queer communities and queer oppression that has created different subcultures, that has created the requirements. For example, for a hanky code, one that is really subtle and is not overt as it could have been if you were heterosexual, you know, but there's a whole lot of history to a community that we can't just disavow. And some of that history is built in trauma. Some of that history is built in the recognition, acceptance of being different, and embracing that to create these amazing things that we have created, that queers have created over the past, you know, couple of hundred of years when communities have come out in this sort of way. Mm. And I feel like respectability politics doesn't value that history in any way. It tries to disavow that history completely and says, you know, get rid of it because we just want to go back. You know, we want to go to that space, you know, get rid of all those things that have made us different, and make us just like, you know, make it like our history was just the same as a straight person's history, you know, the history of straight people.
I think there's a really interesting idea there that, We've talked a bit before about the way that identity politics kind of divorces the idea of a kind of essential, like, gay identity, for example, from culture and from history. And so I think there's kind of an interesting question about, like, how much in the age of identity politics, you know, that is, we are living in it, whether we want to be or not, how much do queers owe to a connection to that legacy? And I feel like a way of kind of getting it, that I feel like we've kind of skipped something. I feel like we've missed something here because we've jumped straight into kind of everything we don't like about politics, which is easy to do because it's awful, I think, is to go back to those responses to Brendan's video and, you know, just as an example, but really you could use anything like this that comes up. And try to think about why do people have these really negative reactions? Try to imagine from the perspective of, you know, Joe Gabo on Twitter, who's watched the video and gone, this doesn't represent me, I'm disgusted by this. Where does that reaction come from?
Well, like, I think there's potential multiple places that could come from. I think that part of it comes potentially from histories of homophobia and response mechanisms as a way to deal with homophobia.
Being those mechanisms essentially being homophobic.
Yeah, in many ways. Yeah, you're right. But a lot of it is very, you know, that sort of idea that we are attacked because of difference, so therefore we should eschew difference, or we should hide from it as a way to protect ourselves. And I can understand that in a sense of, you know, trying to protect yourself as an individual at that particular point of time. I think part of it also comes up from the fact that people are different, and that some people grow up in communities or in families that don't have as sexually open a world, and just because you're gay doesn't mean that you automatically will then jump into the sorts of sexual things that Brendan's video talks about, and that's fine.
Sure. I feel like not many gay men come out and a week later they're getting fisted.
Yeah, exactly. And that's fine, and that's not like a criticism of those people. But I can see at least how they wouldn't be able to connect to something like this. I think that there's an extra step of going, I don't connect to this, and therefore you should stop doing it. And I think that's the extra step that I disagree with and I don't like. But I can see how people at least won't connect with it. And just because you identify as gay doesn't mean you identify with all of these sorts of practices.
Of course. But I guess that kind of argument that it shouldn't exist, or that it shouldn't be done, or it should be done kind of shamefully or secretly is that it's that extra step that I think is interesting. And I guess my read, you know, to the extent to which you can ascribe these sorts of motivations to people, it's based in a fear of being it's a fear of rejection, essentially, by society, that, you know, queer people, for very good reasons, fear that rejection anyway, often based in very specific experience of that. But, you know, given our dominant political framework, and I think this is a big problem that this is the case, but it is nonetheless the case, is one of acceptance, is one of inclusion within existing social structures, and marriage is a really good example of that. I think that anything that is seen to undermine the kind of, you know, respectability of queer people is seen as a kind of threat to that political project. And that's obviously a kind of maybe complex idea to ascribe to someone in that moment. But I think that is what's going on in the background. And you see that sometimes explicitly. I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but something that I did at my... So I worked for a sexual health organisation, and LGBTI health organization, and we every year we do this big survey of kind of the sex and sexual health and drug use of gay and bisexual men, and so that's been going on for a long time, and we release the data every year, and it happens across Australia, and it's always really, really fascinating. And last year I kind of drove this, I really wanted to do something quite interesting with the data and with the results, just because some of it's so great. I mean, there's stuff like, one of the most interesting findings, I thought was this, the fact that the most common, open relationships were the most common type of relationship.
Yes. I remember this now.
Yeah.
It's taken me a minute to click.
Totally. So that was really fascinating. Obviously, you know, all the caveats here, it's a survey, it's self-selected, so that obviously has an impact on the outcomes that you get, but still a kind of fascinating, I think even despite all of that, still a fascinating thing. And so we put out, we did a bunch of media around some of these results, and the reaction was really intense, very often very negative, and there were marriage equality advocates. Some I would say that the probably the most high profile marriage equality activist in the country, a guy named Rodney Croom, took to social media to just absolutely attack these findings and explicitly say, I don't want to kind of misquote him here because I can't remember exactly what he said, but essentially saying, how dare you kind of undermine our fight for marriage equality by saying that this is representative of gay men. It's not. He attacked the methodology of the study. And I guess more importantly, just said, it is damaging for you to even say this, for you to even say that gay men are in open relationships, doing XYZ. And I mean, that's like.
I remember this. It was really strong and really, really angered me.
Totally. And I feel like it's rare that you see respectability politics play out in such an explicit way, where it is somebody literally saying, this is undermining our political project of inclusion and equality.
Yeah, so I can relate to that as well. I think, you know, if we're going to, let's just tell one more story. So, as probably most of our listeners know, I am in a polyamorous relationship and have written about that publicly a number of times. The first time a couple of years ago now, around about. And in the times that I've written about that, I often will post, there's a few like gay Facebook groups and stuff that I'm a member of that sort of post articles and links and stuff like that. And I've often posted articles I write there, or I've seen people post articles that I write there, or articles about polyamory. And what's the most interesting reaction I've ever had, and I've commented this publicly, that the people who I've received the most negative reaction, I've been largely accepted by family and friends, but the people I receive stronger negative reactions from are gay men in particular, and largely it is exactly the same argument. I've had people say, you should not talk about this until we've won marriage equality, because every time you talk about this, you undermine marriage equality. How dare you even speak publicly about this? Literally people saying, you can talk about this after we've won marriage equality, but please be quiet now. And it enrages me, because if you were to dare say to a gay man, don't talk about your relationship, you know, your monogamous relationship, because it's undermining, you know, because of any reason at all, you would rightfully be attacked for being homophobic. You would rightfully be attacked for you know, silencing them, for making it so that they can't be proud about who they are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's this a respectability politics that's tied in with particular campaigns that mean that you don't just have the right to people who aren't just, you know, feeling like, well, that doesn't connect with me, but also saying, well, you know, you don't actually even have the right to engage in this conversation because you are undermining me. Somehow you talking about your relationship undermines my relationship, which is the very thing that people who are against marriage equality have been saying for a long time, that, you know, this undermines straight relationships, and we've rightfully attacked that, but we then turn around and use the same stuff against people who don't fit the marriage equality mold, or the respectable mold that we like. And this is the thing that's really angered me about marriage equality for a long time. Not the content necessarily, not, you know, pass the bloody marriage equality law. The thing that angers me is a language that has ended up evolving to actually in many ways be very, very similar to the language that was used initially against marriage equality campaigns, but just targeted at a different, you know, minority group. In your case, people in open relationships, you know, but people who want to have, you know, who want to talk explicitly about sex, people in polyamorous relationships, a lot of the language is very, very similar to what was used against marriage equality many years ago, or still is used against marriage equality.
And I would argue that, I would go beyond. I feel like it's tempting to say that there is a separation between the issue itself being access to an institution like marriage and the tactics used in the campaign. And we can, you know, I certainly am often tempted to kind of sit there and go, I have no problem with marriage. I have no problem with marriage equality as a kind of goal. Although, God, I even hate the term marriage equality. I feel like whenever I'm like talking about it derisively, I specifically use gay marriage. But for hopefully obvious reasons, I feel like it's pretty easy to make the argument that it's actually an inevitable outcome of fighting for this issue at all.
I would argue it is.
Controversial thing to say.
I would argue it is. And I think that, what's interesting is that particularly in Australia, given how long it's taking for this to occur, I think you're seeing this sort of long-term inevitable outcome of fighting for this issue, because the argument gets sort of refined more and more and more as sort of the political obstruction continues on and on and on. And so you get the sort of really vile reactions you got towards, you know, this video, for example, or what you got to the media that you were doing last year, where, you know, people are literally attacking people for being in consensual relationships, that they're happy, in, and saying that that doesn't, you know, that's something we shouldn't be talking about, or we should refuse to talk about. And that's, you know, that is the inevitable outcome of this in a sort of long-term play kind of way.
Sure. I mean, I think the other issue it brings up, and this is something we've touched on a little, but I mean, even in the last episode we did, although didn't get into it to a significant degree, is internalized homophobia, and that there, it's kind of worth saying again and again and again, and we don't say it enough, that there is a lot of homophobia in queer communities, a lot of it, you know, and I feel like I almost don't want to say internalized homophobia because that's become such a loaded term. I mean, often it's externalized. I mean, the stuff that we're talking about is just straight up homophobia.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we could do a better job. I mean, you know, we being, I don't know who are queers, of just saying, there is a lot of homophobia out there. On some level, maybe that's about calling it out, though that's kind of a limited strategy. I think it's also about just creating a space where people are allowed to acknowledge the existence of homophobia in queer communities.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that this is, last week we talked about a lot about internalized homophobia. And going on to this, what we can see is that externalized version of that. And I think that recognizing a lot of respectability politics as externalized homophobia, as queers attacking other queers for the things that they do in consensual manners, is externalized homophobia. It's homophobia.
Yeah. I mean, again, I almost don't like that kind of internalized externalized distinction, because it's like, it's kind of all the same shit, I think. Like, I would rather just call it homophobia.
Yeah, okay. Yep, that's fair. I mean, I think that's fair, and I think it's an interesting distinction that maybe we don't have time to really dive into today, but I'd like to think about that more, because I think it is worthwhile. We talk about internalized homophobia a lot, but it is worthwhile thinking about whether that term is actually just useless, because you think about that as a thing that, you know, makes you hate yourself but doesn't actually get projected out to other people. But what we're talking about here is homophobia that's being projected onto other people in different forms. But I think most interestingly about that is that it's also homophobia that is getting legitimized through particular campaigns that are acting against homophobia, if that makes sense, which is...
At least officially
against homophobia. So, and that's, I think, the fascinating part about this is that it's a legitimization of homophobia through equal rights campaigns. And that's I guess the really challenging part of this is that if we see a lot of respectability politics as homophobia, then what you're actually saying is that a lot of the civil rights campaigns that queers have fought for are homophobic. And that's that's a thing that I hadn't thought of until right now, and that's a bit of a mind shift and something that's worth thinking about.
That's great. I mean, it's awful, but you know, it's such a great idea. We should probably wrap.
I reckon that's a good place to wrap up, because I'm gonna have to go back and deal with that.
The only I just wanted to ask one more question briefly that we sort of touched on at the start, and I did want to come back to is that question again of whether really kind of shocking or explicit content like Brendan McLean's video is an effective weapon against respectability politics. I mean, and I suppose, you know, I would say that it is, partly because it brings it out into the open and really gets people to actually articulate these shitty ideas that bubble along under the surface of campaigns like the Marriage Equality, or often on the surface of the Marriage Equality campaign. And I think that the more that we're talking openly about this stuff, the more opportunities we have to challenge it and say that it's bad. So I think it absolutely has value in that respect. And also, obviously, as just a way to normalize, normalize is a crappy word as well, but I guess highlight our otherness and make people maybe feel a bit better about About difference.
Yeah, look, I think it is an effective tool. I think it's an effective tool. I don't think it could be the only tool.
Sure.
But I think it definitely is. I mean, the very fact that this leads to this sort of debate is often valuable, in that it opens up the question a lot more than a, you know, Australian marriage equality video that, you know, just talks about how much we love each other, you know, video does, I think. And I think that in... Even, you know, just say, you know, just say, imagine the debates, you know, the discussions you and I are having, but probably more heated in many places around Australia following this video. I think that is valuable in just, you know, in allowing people to express different views and express different understandings of what being queer means and gives space for that. And I think that's valuable in and of itself. And yes, I think the other thing that it does is it, normalizing is really a bad word because it's not right, but it does open space for the discussion of these sorts of sexual acts and these sorts of, you know, this sorts of the hanky code and all of this stuff that previously existed and continues to exist, and allows queers who may not be aware of that to be able to be like, hey, that's a thing, you know, that is interesting and that I might want to explore more or I might want to engage in, and I'm totally pro that.
Well, that's it for us today, I think. Thank you, as always, for listening, and we will be back with another episode in a couple of weeks.
In the meantime, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com or subscribe to us on iTunes. And as always, please leave a review and rating, which helps other people find us. It's not just for our vanity.
We have had a few really lovely reviews recently on iTunes, so keep those up. That's very much appreciated.
It is.
In the meantime, remember that we have our new email address, so you can email us at queerspodcast@gmail.com. And you can, as always, find us on Twitter. I'm at Ben C. Riley.
And I'm at Simon Copland, and I'm also on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
We'll see you all next time.
Looking forward to it.